have some folks who have traveled quite a distance for Senate Bill 495, and we'll try to get 650 done as quickly as possible for Senator Morissette, and then we'll move to the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bill Morissette, Senator from District 6. And with me, Mark D'Anzo from the Office of Emergency Management and George Priest from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and both of them will testify on behalf of Senate Bill, whatever bill we have, 650. Thank you. Briefly, a background of this. As mayor, I belong to the Lane Council of Governments, and we met on the coast several years ago and had a presentation by Mark. Were you there then at that time? Anno was there, I know, and Anno. And the Lane Council of Governments had a presentation on tsunami and the damage that a tsunami could do, the likelihood that at some point, the certainty at some point, we would have a major tsunami because of the zone that we're part of. And that really piqued my interest. And so I've always been interested in this. And last session, I did introduce this bill that would require some sort of warning system and uniformity along the Oregon coast, because most of the people there, depending on the time of year and the day, may not be aware of the inherent dangers. Some parts of the coast, you will hear, are very, very susceptible. The northern beaches, for instance, thousands of people could die at a particular time of year and day. Other parts of the coast, there is high ground where people could go and the damage to life and property would be minimized. However, the thing that we don't have is we have no uniformity. We have very little warning. That's some motels do a good job. The Inn at Spanish Head, for instance, does a wonderful job. They have signs all over the place. I attended a conference this summer. We had a work session to deal with this. Senator Starr was there, Representative Hobson was there, and the entire coastal delegation was involved in the discussion of this and the support of this concept. And so we do have a bill now that would establish some uniformity both in the warning system and the directions on how to evacuate and what to look for. And there is in their packet a very timely piece of material that deals with the Cascadia region earthquake scenario. And if you look through this, you'll see what will happen throughout the western part of the state if we do have a level 9 earthquake. Now, that's pretty heavy duty. It's been 300 years or so since that occurred, but it will occur at some point. But it will not only impact the coast itself, but it will impact some of the inland regions, not only during that time, but with aftershocks. So it is a major, major concern, should be a major concern for people, not only people who live on the Oregon coast, but people who visit. And the visitors will be most vulnerable if they have no idea what's going on. So with that, I will end my testimony, and I'm not sure, Mark or George, which one of you, George?
You know what I'm going to do, gentlemen?
Yeah.
Since Senator Morissette's done, I'm going to close the hearing now so that we can get the Pendleton folks in here out of respect for them. And if you guys will just stand by, I think
sure.
This is going to be short and sweet.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Senator Morissette. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 650 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 495. Mark, would you explain what this bill does, please?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 495 revises the factors used by an arbiter in public employee collective bargaining for purposes of selecting the last best offer package.
Thank you very much. I think we have Larry Lehman. And you can bring up your counsel if you wish and League of LGPI 2. I forgot to have you read this amount of law. I'm sorry. Just kicked me when I do that.
Well, I... I didn't know that. He was very...
Please proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Larry Lehman, the city manager of the city of Pendleton. I'm urging you to send Senate Bill 495 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. In 2002, Pendleton engaged in collective bargaining with both its police and fire employees, represented by different unions. In each case, because these employees are prohibited from striking, we had to bargain with you to what an arbitrator would award if bargaining failed, and we were subject to mandatory bargaining. Because of the provisions of ORS 243, in each case, the employees' union brought forward comparable wage packages for the employees providing services to other cities of similar size to Pendleton and throughout the state. There is no hard and fast rule for how many cities a department is required to be compared to. The selection is based solely on population size. In our bargaining with our firefighters, Pelham was compared to Plymouth Falls, Forest Grove, Newburgh, Coos Bay, Redmond, and Wilsonville. Of these, Forest Grove, Newburgh, and Wilsonville are in the metropolitan area, and Wilsonville is served by Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, the largest fire district in the state. None of these in the same geographical area as Pendleton. We had to bargain being aware of the fact that if bargaining failed, we would not be permitted to rely on local compensation packages of other cities in our labor market, which is primarily the rural cities of eastern Oregon. The problem with ORS 243 was particularly acute in the case of bargaining with the firefighters. They reminded us often of ORS 243 during the bargaining sessions. Our compensation before bargaining is competitive in our labor market. Our last vacancy in the fire service was in October 2001. Turnover is not an issue in Pendleton. In spite of our stable workforce, we settled with the firefighters for a total increase in wages of 17% over 3 years. In 2002, before taking into account the 17% increase, 13 of our 21 firefighters had total annual wages of more than $55,000 a year. Seven of these had total wages of more than $60,000, and three more than $70,000. I want to emphasize that these are wages, not including benefits. In Pendleton, the median earnings for, and this would come out of the census, we wanted just to get the median earnings, but they had it listed between male and female. So this one here would be the median earnings for a male full-time year-round worker is $33,350. Most employees in the private sector do not receive the excellent health and retirement benefits that our employees, particularly public safety employees, receive. In the case of police employee bargaining, we did not have to anticipate a comparison with a special district. We did have to use the same cities for comparison. We believe we already paid wages above the local labor market. Faced with the anticipated results from arbitration, the city settled with the police employees for a total increase in wages of 16% over the 3 years. The total cost to our taxpayers, police and firemen, is right at $100,000 per year. In addition, those taxpayers are having to pay substantial increases in health insurance and retirement benefits for the next few years, in addition to the increase in wages. In spite of the many steps taken over the past 12 years since the voters adopted ballot measure 5 to reduce cost, we are faced with a very real possibility of reducing our firefighting and police forces. And the requirements of ORS 243 is a great contributor forcing those reductions in public safety. We have no problem in trying to pay a reasonable wage. That is not the issue. And we think we do that. What we're asking is to be able to have that compared to labor force in our area. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, Mr. Lehman, if you were just reviewing your testimony, in Pendleton, the median earnings for male full-time year-round workers was $33,350, and then you've got a few people earning more than $55,000. What is the salary of a city manager?
Probably close to the top of the fire department.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Actually, I got a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Menes.
Mr. Lehman, did I hear you correctly that the city settled for the 17% increase instead of going to arbitration?
Yes, we did.
Why did you choose not to go to arbitration?
We looked at what happened in Astoria and also in Ashland. And looking at what those there, it seemed like it was not worth the additional expense to do that, because it looked like, because of the way they interpret ORS 243, that we would be stuck with this or worse.
Well, currently, for the law, the arbiter includes economic capacity, the ability of a local agency to pay the salary. So why wouldn't that be sufficient to make your argument?
And we did not use that as a bargaining objection. We did not say that the city could not afford it at that time.
So you're saying the city could afford it, you just didn't want to afford it.
That is correct. Right. And the rationale would be, yes, we may be able to afford it this year, but as we get way above, like the $100,000 mark, then we have to make reductions. And now we're hitting that this year.
Does the city of Pendleton have a reserve police department?
A small one, yes.
How many?
I think we've got probably only three or four reserves.
Do you have volunteer firefighters?
We have a few fire reserves, we call them, and I think we have like 10.
10. Okay. Do you have volunteer teachers?
Not that I know of.
All right, thank you.
And our firemen are also EMS. We also run the ambulance service.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Anything else, Senator?
No.
Good afternoon. I'm Maria Keltner. I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities. I turned in some written testimony. I'm just going to hit a few highlights. And I also understand that the City of Astoria submitted some written testimony to, has that been distributed? Thank you. Chair Corcoran and members of the committee, the League of Oregon Cities supports Senate Bill 495. There are four separate parts to it. The primary part, which City Administrator Larry Lehman has just testified to, deals with comparables and the issue with small communities, small cities within the Tualatin Valley Fire District and also within Clackamas County Fire District, who don't have their own fire service, being used as comparators using the larger district's compensation in setting rates for North Bend, Astoria, and Ashland are the places where it has happened so far. In two of those cases, in Ashland and in Astoria and in North Bend, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue was counted twice because there were two cities of comparable population within their area, which created interesting skewed results depending on your perspective of looking at comparables for those two small communities. So the League of Oregon Cities supports the changes in the bill and the rest of the information in my testimony.
Does an arbitrator have the option of rejecting particular comparables?
The arbitrator is to select either the total package, the last best offer that the union presents, or the total package, last best offer that the employer presents. And so how they look at each of the criteria in light of selecting one or the other of those packages is sometimes difficult to determine when they're saying, here's the criteria and I'll select this package or this package.
So another answer to that question might be, yes, they do.
The direction is use these criteria and select one package or the other.
And the arguments for the particular packages are based on comparables?
Among several other criteria.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran. It's a pleasure to be here and testify in front of your committee.
Wish I would be under better circumstances.
Chair Corcoran, I have no prepared testimony other than to lend my support for the city of Pendleton and the testimony they've been giving you. I'm aware in general of what that is, and I certainly can vouch for the fact that it presents a major problem for us in the community of Pendleton. and as a consequence would encourage you to look carefully at this legislation and see if there's anything you can do to help alleviate what I believe is a wrong, an unintended wrong for us in the state.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. We have Jim Botwinis and Brian DeLashman. Why don't you guys come up?
Jim. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'll try and make this very short and sweet. We are opposed to 495. Simply from the amendments that are proposed in the bill, 4A, which adds to the sentence, the interest and welfare of the public as it reads now, to include as defined or determined by the governing body of the unit of government. Quite frankly, that allows that governmental body to establish whatever policies, city charters that they want to establish, and they go to the table and they say, this is our last, best and final offer. Why would we waste our time going to an arbitrator? They've established that policy. There's no place else to go. So, in essence, this bill kills binding arbitration for public safety employees, and if that's the case, then maybe we should have the right to strike. Thank you.
So, Mr. Botwinis, are you trying to give us some indication? I've never seen you in anything but blue. Are you trying to show what would happen to the state police if they decided to put uniforms on you guys on St. Patty's Day?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
You look like the Multnomah County Sheriff.
Look like that's right. I wouldn't be able to tell them apart. Mr. DeLashman.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. And I have the blessing of representing Bob Livingston and the firefighters because they're both at their national convention, he and Pat West. We have the same concerns. Specifically, nothing on page one, it looks to me like it's language, just a little cleanup, but as Mr. Botwinis it indicated, the first one that struck me was line 8 and line 9. In essence, what you're saying there is that the interest and welfare of the public is to be considered, and it's heavily weighted under the current criteria, but it's as defined by the governing body. So, in fact, they set the rules. And the arbitrator has absolutely no flexibility on that. I think that's even more weighted than the criteria are as current. The cost of local government, and you heard the testimony from the folks in Pendleton, we believe, and I know the firefighters believe, that comparables are comparables and that both sides get the ability to present what they think are comparables, and then, of course, the arbiter decides who's right and who's wrong. And so we would oppose this bill.
Any questions? Yes, Senator.
I'm interested in this because the last best offer scenario really leaves the arbiter with just one of two choices. Whereas before we had interest arbitration where the arbiter could pick from the various arguments made by the parties. And since Senate Bill 750 passed, this is the choice that we have. So it's interesting to me that we have a city who's coming wanting to change the environment within which that interest arbitration would occur, but not go back to a modality where the arbiter has the ability to pick and choose within a range of considerations and arguments. So maybe the argument ought to be much larger than that's posed in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if you're leading me in the direction I think you're suggesting, we would be more than interested in opening up the discussion around 750, and so it's not last best, but in fact it goes back to the old system of each item is weighted on its own basis, and an arbiter gets to decide who's right on this particular issue, who's right on this particular issue, and who's right on this particular issue. We think that's preferable in the first place. Senate Bill 750 started us down this path, set the weighted criteria, and now this goes one step beyond that.
And Mr. Chairman, do you recall who supported Senate Bill 750? As far as did the League of Oregon Cities support it?
They can speak for themselves, but I know that it was not the employee unions that were supporting it, so I assume it was the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities that were the main drivers.
Mr. Chairman, I just find it kind of interesting that isn't my recollection. I could be wrong, but I do believe the cities supported it. So now to come and tweak around the edges of it without looking at the entire picture, to me, is somewhat offensive. So
we will be closing public hearing on Senate Bill 495. Thank you very much. And we'll reopen public hearing on Senate Bill 650. And we're joined by the wonderful representative from the South Coast, Representative Berger. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Joanne Berger, Oregon State Representative from District 9.
Representative Berger, hold on just a second so we can just put this on the record. Would you please tell us what Senate Bill 495 does, or excuse me, Senate Bill 650 does, please?
Senator Corcoran and members of the committee, Senate Bill 650 requires the Office of Emergency Management to establish a tsunami warning information, evacuation plans, and uniform tsunami warning signals. It requires transient lodging facilities located within the tsunami inundation zones to post tsunami warning information and evacuation plans.
Does that include a 1% room tax? Never mind, just a joke. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Berger.
Yes, again, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Joanne Berger from District 9. I'm here to support this bill. I just want to share with you something that happened on the Oregon coast to give you a little bit better feel for the needs that we have. We had a tsunami warning in Coos Bay. We had a somewhat loosely planned evacuation route. When the media announced that we were going to have waves, very high waves of possible tsunami, people in the community rushed out and got on the highway going out to see the waves. We had a disaster. Luckily, we didn't have a tsunami. After that, as mayor of the city, I became alarmed that the people, many of the people in the low-lying areas, had no idea that there was anything happening. And so we found an old World War II siren, air raid siren, and had it rebuilt, and it is in Empire at the fire hall as we speak. And so we have about once a month, I think, or every 6 weeks, they turn this thing on so that people in the low-lying areas get accustomed to the fact that that means there's a tsunami. We have an evacuation route that is now marked somewhat that is different than if everybody started out to the coast. This is a good bill. This is a necessary bill. It could be used even for other things. I'm sure you understand what I mean by that, other than a tsunami, but certainly for the tsunami warnings and for visitors who are in hotels and motels out in Charleston in those low-lying areas. If they don't know about it, then we're in real trouble. So I'm here to strongly support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Any questions, Representative? I'll tell you, I would be one of those fools rushing to the beach. I've always wanted enough of a tsunami warning to be able to go up to Cape Perpetua and watch one of those suckers hit the coast, but I understand your concerns. So. That's right. And we could even choose the party. No, never mind. Would you gentlemen like to go ahead with your testimony?
Sure. Now, Senator Corcoran, I'm George Priest with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I've come before your committee to testify in support of the bill. Our agency is responsible for actually mapping where this so-called tsunami inundation or flooding happens, and we got involved in this back in 1995 when with essentially no budget we were asked to implement this bill, which zones all critical and non-essential facilities out, that are going to be built new outside of the inundation zone, making it impossible to build a number of critical facilities in that zone. I had to draw that line for the entire Oregon coast. I did it in about 6 months with very, very, very little budget, but we did do it, and there is now a flooding line for the entire Oregon coast, and that bill and then the rules that go with it are addressed in this bill as a way of implementing this particular bill. So any hotels or motels, for instance, that are in the inundation zone defined in 1995 would be affected. And just from my own experience, I know exactly where this line is. It's really not very many hotels and lodging facilities, with a few exceptions, places like Seaside, where the whole town is below 30 feet in elevation, and some state parks that are right on the beach are mainly the ones that are going to be affected by this. So I just want to give you that as background. The line that was drawn in 1995, again for background, was based on a magnitude 9 earthquake. The tsunami flooding we would expect from that, it was based on computer modeling and some a great deal of professional judgment on my part. The thing to realize is that elevation is probably 30 to 40 feet in elevation all along the coast. It is the way it's actually drawn, and it goes inland generally no more than about a mile, even in very low-lying areas. Beyond a mile, it's just bank splash up on the estuarine banks. So I don't want you to think of this as the whole western half of Oregon is being inundated by this event. That's based on science. And now the other thing I'd like to have you notice is that it's also not taking into account distant events. Distant tsunamis from like the Gulf of Alaska, we have 4 hours of warning, and historically even a magnitude 9 plus event, which has already happened in 1964, was a relatively modest inundation. There were two lives lost, a little bit of property damage, but these are not the events that our agency is stressing in any of our mapping. What we're stressing is this local earthquake, magnitude 9. We know it happened 300 years ago, and that it will arrive after the shaking in 10 to 30 minutes. And it's absolutely anything that this body can do to get the coastal public, particularly the visiting public, which is much less clued into this danger than the residents, anything you can do to get them ready for this event, posting things in rooms, putting up signs, is just part of that whole educational process. And I'd like you to think of this in the context of homeland security. If this event were to happen, it's very likely that we would lose tens of thousands of lives on a typical holiday weekend. There's nothing short of nuclear attack that's going to cause this kind of life loss in the state of Oregon. I'll pass it off to Mark Carrianzo.
Any questions? No questions? Please proceed.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. And my name is Mark Carrianzo, and I'm the Earthquake and Tsunami Program Coordinator for the State Office of Emergency Management. And I wanted to reiterate what George is saying, that the tourist population is probably the most vulnerable because they are transient and they really are the most unaware because they come from many different places, oftentimes from the interior of the United States, that don't know very much about tsunamis. So I think in any way we can raise that awareness with the tourist population is a good thing. Also, last year we had a tsunami warning workshop where we actually brought together different coastal emergency managers, responders, legislatures from the coast to Lincoln City to discuss tsunami warning. And it's important to be consistent with warning signals, and also it's important to locate these tsunami warning systems strategically and to make sure you can reach the people that need to be reached. And we had about 20 recommendations that came out of that workshop, and in fact one of the recommendations, and it's written here in bold in the testimony, is to create a uniform tsunami warning signal. And all the people that were in that workshop bought into it, and all coastal counties were represented on that. And finally, I'd like to talk more about this statewide earthquake exercise that we're having in April 2nd and 3rd and 8th and 9th. It's not mentioned here, but Senator Morissette did mention it a little bit. But what it is, it's based on a magnitude 9 earthquake and, of course, tsunamis. And it's a statewide earthquake exercise participating. Many counties and cities on the coast and inland are participating in this, and we're producing a magnitude 9 earthquake, and we're producing a tsunami, and so we're actually testing this because we think this is important to test, because if it does happen, it will be cause quite a bit of damage and loss of life. Thank you.
One question I have, Mr. Carrianzo, is I've had
had occasion to travel the coast a lot as in my employment, and there's complete dead spots both going south from Winchester Bay down to Brookings and going north up to Newport. It says in here that, you know, tune to local media. Do we know if people would have access to a local radio station all along the coast?
I'm not positive. I know that there's some spots that are weak as far as radio transmission, but there is no weather radio coverage. And actually, there was a couple of grants that were provided to the state of Oregon to increase their NOAA weather radio coverage. So if you may not be able to get connections to a radio station, but NOAA weather radio, the coverage is pretty complete along the coast. And so we're trying to encourage people to purchase NOAA weather radios that actually will come on with a tsunami warning from the National Weather Service. And so we're encouraging that. And I think that with that and with these grants to put up repeaters, where our coverage will be much better than it was before, and so we should have almost all coverage on the coast. But I know in some cases, like Rockaway Beach, their connection to a radio station is kind of weak.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we try to get redundancy, and one way to get redundancy is to offer different ways to get the word out, and encouraging NOAA the radios is a good idea. And that could be done from, you can use it for other hazards as well.
And then my only other question to you was, does your agency anticipate any fiscal impact to the agency for the development of this?
I think the only thing we looked at, well, right now I'm being, well, my job was eliminated, and then I'm being funded through the tsunami program, and George, through the NOAA funds that are coming through, and through an interagency agreement, I'm being paid to do tsunami work as well as earthquake work. And so it's a kind of a long answer to it, but basically what's happening is there is funding to, I'm funded to do this stuff for the task force, and this came out of the task force. So yes, I think to answer your question, there's really be no fiscal impact unless when my funding is ended and this administrative rule process continues on beyond that, then if I don't get funded further beyond January of 04, then someone will have to do that, and OEM will have to find someone within their office to continue with that on. But I don't see it as a big problem, so there's some little bit of fiscal impact, but not a lot.
Well, I'm assuming because Mr. Priest is speaking in favor of the motion that it's not a particular concern to Dogami then.
Well, our agency generally every year gets a certain level of federal support for tsunami preparedness research and so on. And we stand prepared to actually produce the educational materials that'll implement this for lodging facilities.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Anybody else to speak about this bill? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 650. What do you think? Should we move it?
Yep.
You're okay to move it? All right. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 650.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menas.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 650 to the floor of the Senate with a due-pass recommendation.
Senator Menas moves Senate Bill 650 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
The fiscal, we don't have a statement. Do we just believe that this is going to be minimal enough that we don't need to worry about it?
I'm going to look at the Dogami representative here and ask. You talked about the fact that federal funds cover this currently.
The federal funds cover basically educational materials that might be required. We're actually producing a CD right now that'll be a tutorial for all lodging facilities. We still have to, of course, write those next proposals to the feds and then decide how we're actually going to, you know, fund some of these things. What we really don't know right now is what the final rules might be and how it's all going to be implemented. Clearly, we don't have the funding to go out and buy siren systems, but
right.
You know, we do have modest funds to throw at the educational component.
Great, thank you. Thank you, and I would stress that under the summary, it's to establish warning information, evacuation plans, and warning signal. So
yes,
it's not as ambitious as having to provide all the resources infrastructure resources.
Yeah, correct. The only details that our agency had some question about, perhaps, would be exactly how it's enforced, and that would be handled by the rule process, the rule writing process.
Senator Miss?
My assumption is the local governments may want to participate, so they may have local funds they may want to invest.
Just anecdotally, in my conversations with local fire chiefs, they didn't see any problem with adding this kind of thing to their normal duties for fire in inspections to make sure there's a little tsunami material in the rooms of lodging facilities and so on.
They get paid the big buck.
That's right.
That's at least in Pendleton. That's right. Any other questions?
No.
Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair Plunkett?
Aye. Senate Bill 650 will go to the floor. And do we have any volunteers? Senator Morissette, you want to carry it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is competency not a... Yeah. Okay, Senator Morissette will carry it. Thank you very much. Close that hearing. Thank you very much. All right. Let's move to
767.
Who do we have here on 676?
Do you want to wait a minute?
I think we have a few more on 2004. We don't have the sheet on 2004 yet. Okay. Bear with us for just a second. I'm trying to figure out which one makes more sense to run through, if you don't mind waiting. Okay. Okay, well, let's go ahead and do 676. Public hearing on Senate Bill 676, please. Can you explain what the bill does?
So, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 676 modifies the control and regulation of state-owned standard passenger vehicles and also of light-duty trucks.
Thank you very much. And we have Rod Lohoff, Fleet Department of Administrative Services. So, Mr. Lohoff, this is the result of a interim task force, I assume, and you're going to give us the recommendation of that task force?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rod Lohoff. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services. DAS Fleet recommends passage of Senate Bill 676. The purpose of this bill is to implement two recommendations of the State-Owned Vehicle Efficiency Task Force. These recommendations are on page 7 of the report, which has been distributed. The current process for exemption to the mileage criteria are confusing and difficult to enforce. DAS Fleet is responsible for evaluating all exemptions. DAS Fleet does not have the expertise of each agency's mission to make informed sources decisions. This bill provides a more realistic approach. User agencies will be responsible for determining necessity. DAS Fleet will monitor use and require annual justification of vehicles failing to meet mileage criteria. The bill will expand vehicles covered to all light-duty vehicles instead of only sedans and station wagons. Current replacement criteria is currently based solely on mileage also. Consultant performing a mandated biannual fleet review recommended age and use of the vehicle in addition to mileage for replacement criteria. Using a wider base of justification should mean vehicles are replaced when most cost-effective. This bill improves current statutes by tying definition of alternative fuels to Federal Environmental Protection Agency criteria, expands vehicles covered to include SUVs, vans, and pickups, requires agencies to justify a vehicle need that does not meet the mileage threshold by criteria recommended in the statewide fleet review, expands replacement criteria to all vehicles under 8,500 gross vehicle weight, requires DAS rules to establish replacement standards that include mileage, age, and economy of operation. This bill places the responsibility of justifying need to the using agency. The agency is most familiar with these needs and best prepared to determine necessity. Replacement criteria is expanded to allow a more cost-effective replacement decision. By implementing the recommendations, vehicle utilization and replacement should improve.
That's the end of my testimony. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Question, Senator Menace?
Who would be exempt from this standard in the state system?
Those agencies that are exempt from RS 283, which would include lottery, SAFE, and there are a couple of small commissions that are also exempt.
Is the higher education community exempt?
Pardon?
Higher education? Are they exempt?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, no, they are not exempt.
Senator Starr? None? Let's vote this.
Okay. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 676 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
Senate Bill 676 to the floor of the Senate. The due pass recommendation unamended.
Senator Menace moves to the Senate Bill 676 unamended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 676 has the votes. It will move. And let's see, this is a huge cost-saving measure. Who wants to carry this? You want me to carry it? You want to carry it? You're the transportation guru.
Sure.
All right, Senator Starr, thank you very much. Close the hearing. All right, now we'll go to a work session on House Bill 2004. And we have some amendments to look at here. Mr. Ellsworth, we have had a series of, we've gone from 13 to 14 to 15 to 16, and we have a separate one, 17. Would you like to walk us through this turkey chase here?
I'd be happy to, Chair Corcoran. Let me see if I can get into the coop here. It was recognized in Dash 13 that on page 2, line 4, the text of the measure of the amendment read on page 2. That should have read on page 3. Those changes were submitted to council, and the Dash A14 were given to make that change happen.
Okay.
It was then noticed that on line 20 that it read, the board shall then calculate the retirement allowance. And council was notified of that problem. And the Dash 16, actually, it happened in 14, and they didn't change it in the Dash 15, and they thought they had. They were then changed for the Dash 16.
Okay, so the Dash 16, as far as we're aware, is the original Dash 13s without mistakes.
Correct.
Okay. Do you folks have anything to say about that, Mr. Boyko? I know it's a policy matter, but I want to see if there's any technical comments on it.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we did have an opportunity to look at Dash 16 very quickly, and it appears as though it's housekeeping and typos, that it doesn't change any of the fundamental policies that were developed in the House and sent over, nor the additional change that Representative Canope and Representative McPherson discussed with you in your last hearing with respect to the point of measurement for the look-back. So it appears as though they are exactly what you characterize them as.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions on this particular amendment? Okay. I would like a motion, if we could, to move this particular amendment into 2004. Senator Menace?
Move the adoption of the Dash A16 amendment to House Bill 2004.
Senator Menace moves the Dash A16 amendments into House Bill 2004. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator
Clinton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Chair
Fulton? Aye. So the Dash 16s are now moved into Senate Bill 2004. Now I'd like to take up the issue, since we have Mr. DeLashman here, if he would briefly explain what the Dash 17s, and do our committees don't have a copy. Why don't we stand at ease for just a moment, and we'll get copies for the... I actually probably have enough for the three of us. Yeah, let's just do it that way. Mr. DeLashmet, go ahead and explain. Explain yourself.
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Very simply, these amendments reflect my testimony at the last hearing of 2004, in which, based upon some studies, and the study that I specifically cited was the one that I provided to the committee, the 1999 study, Public Safety Officers in the State of Washington, seems to be that, in fact, a pretty substantial difference in the mortality rate or the age for public safety workers versus general service. And as long as we're dealing with the issue of updating mortality tables, those folks would like to see accurate representations of their life expectancy going in the other direction. Not having that information in the state of Oregon in direct relationship to our PERS, these amendments simply instruct the PERS system to conduct a study, and then when they do their updates in January 1, 2005, if they find a substantial difference, life expectancy, in fact, of public safety officers, traditional public safety officers, is, in fact, shorter in the state, they would establish a separate table.
And is it your understanding, Mr. DeLashmet, that that study would be financed through other than general funds, funds that are available to PERS administratively?
That's my understanding.
Thank you very much.
The one additional thing that I would say is that we tried to construct this looking at the PERS statute. Dave Hendricks and I tried to construct this so we captured the folks that fit the primary definition of police and fire in a traditional role, and that's what the bottom line 17 reflects, the 16 A, B, D, E, F, so on, so on.
Okay, thank you. Question, Senator Starr?
Just a question. I don't know if you're the right person that might answer this, but we might have somebody in the audience that is. In the event that we separate out the police and fire folks out of this, is there potential that there are a significant number of a significant subset of the overall set that they would have the effect of further lengthening the mortality tables for the rest of the set? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I do, but I think
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes, I do understand the question. Obviously, when you're dealing with a table that is, and I don't want to use the word blended, but in essence, when you've got one table now that encompasses everyone, and you make a determination that some subgroup, in fact, is living shorter than on the average, in order to average, there's a possibility that you can move up the other side. I don't know what the total proportion, though, of public safety versus general service. I would suspect it's a smaller subset of the overall number of PERS employees. So I guess I would make the estimate that although it would move it up, it probably would not move it up substantially. But from the information that we've seen, there is a pretty substantial difference, and we want to know in the state of Oregon, because PERS has never separated out the mortality of public safety officers from general service, we thought it would be interesting to find out whether, in fact, there is a substantial difference. But the answer to your question is, yeah, there's a potential of moving the other one slightly longer.
So my intention on this would be to not move this today, but to have some consultation with Representative Knope and get his thoughts on it before we'd actually take any action. Senator Minnis?
Yeah, Brian, just a quick question. What does substantially shorter mean?
Yeah, Dave and I talked about that, and we didn't want to get so prescriptive in the statute that we didn't want to allow the PERS board to make some decision on what was substantially shorter. In my estimation, I was thinking a year or two because the studies we're seeing right now are up to 9 years difference. So that's what I was thinking, substantially shorter. But I would leave that to administrative rules if this were to go into effect.
Okay. It's helpful, I guess, to the extent that this record is of any value, what substantially shorter means. But I would suspect it's sufficiently broad enough that it wouldn't require them to do anything.
That's entirely possible. Obviously, that's the fight that I'm willing to fight administratively, though. I would hope that, again, the record shows that we're not talking about, 10 years or less, because we already think it's 9 years or less, but something that makes a difference. If you figure potentially you're talking 25 years or 30 years of life expectancy after the end of service, and you're talking a couple of years, you're talking, 5 to 7 to 8% difference in their payout, I think that's substantial. If you're talking a number of months, that's probably not worth the effort.
Thank you.
And there's already an assumption of 5 years built into the PNF. So, thank you very much. Any other questions? Seeing none, did anybody else wish to testify on this? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.
What? Work session, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, that was work session. Yes, we closed work session.
Welcome, Senator Moore.
Thank you.